It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Curwood, and joining me today is Dr. Helen Fisher. She's author of the book Why We Love. Dr. Fisher, thanks for joining me.
I'm delighted to be here.
You call your book Why We Love. Well, you might as well ask, why do we exist? But, you know, it turns out from your research that this is more than just a philosophical question. It's also a scientific one. Tell me, please, about your research on this topic.
I have a theory that we've evolved three distinctly different brain systems for mating and reproduction, the sex drive being one, that craving for sexual gratification. The second is romantic love, that in obsession, the craving, the ecstasy, the focused attention, the motivation to win a particular mating partner, that early intense romantic love. And the third brain system is attachment, that sense of calm and security that you can feel with a long-term partner. And I decided that I had already written quite a bit about the sex drive, and actually I'd written quite a bit about attachment. So I began to think to myself, well, you know, this is probably the most powerful experience on earth, romantic love, and maybe I could get some people into a functional MRI brain scanner and see if I can't find out what happens, what the chemistry actually is of this experience.
So an MRI scanner, now this is what, nuclear magnetic resonance? You can see what goes on in someone's head.
What happens in magnetic resonance imaging is that each brain region sucks up blood as it is working because it needs the glucose and the oxygen from the blood. And so if with this scanner, you can see which brain regions are sucking up the blood, which ones are working. And then if you know which region is working and, in fact, which cells in which region are working and you know what those cells do for a living, then you can tell what's going on. And what we did is we put, I and my colleagues, put 32 people who were madly in love into this brain scanner, 17 who were madly in love and their love was accepted, they were happily in love, and 15 who were had just been dumped, they had just been rejected in love. So, but both groups were intensely in love. And
so what happened? You get in there, you get pictures of their brains, and?
Well, a lot of things. But the main thing among those people who were happily in love is activity in a tiny little factory near the base of the brain called the ventral tegmental area. And this little factory actually makes dopamine and sprays dopamine to many brain regions. So we found activity in that part of the brain. We also found activity in something called the caudate nucleus. This is a very large thing. It's about the size of a medium-sized shrimp. And it's on either side of the head. Of course, you've got two things on either side of the head, just the way you've got two arms and two legs. And that's a brain region that receives a lot of dopamine. And together, the caudate nucleus, the ventral tegmental area, and some other brain structures make up what they call the reward system. This is the come-go system, the wanting system, the craving system, the motivation system, the system that actually gives you that elation when things are going well, intense energy, focused attention, dependency. A lot of the addictions are associated with this brain system, and craving, of course, and the motivation to win. And, of course, that's what romantic love is. It's the motivation to win life's greatest prize, the right mating partner.
So as you got images of these people, how could you find these particular regions in their brains to see how they were responding? Let's say the ones that told you that they were madly in love. What would you see actually in the course of the experiment?
Well, what you would see is, what these brain scanners do is they take a slice. I mean, they take a photo. It's like a photograph, a scan, every so many millimeters. So you've got a whole lot of slices going from the top of the brain to the bottom of the brain. And this way you can catch what activity is going on every 5 millimeters in our case. And what the experiment was is these people would look at a photograph of their sweetheart for 30 seconds, one that they had brought into the lab, and they would also look at a neutral photograph, a photograph that called forth no positive or negative feelings in their brain, because we wanted to scan the same brain in that intense stage of romantic love and also in a neutral resting stage.
Wait a second. Just looking at the picture of a loved one is an intense romantic stage?
Sure. I mean, we keep absolutely. As a matter of fact, we did a pre-experiment in which we had people do several different things. Look at a photograph of their sweetheart, read a love letter from their sweetheart, think back at a memory of their sweetheart, smell something that was associated with the sweetheart, listen to some the person's voice, or I can't remember quite what it was some time ago. And we found that the two things that ignite the brain most is thinking back to some wonderful experience in the past and also looking at a photograph of your sweetheart. You know, they call it love at first sight. I mean, it's a, you know, a looking at somebody. That's why we keep pictures in our wallet and pictures on our desk. I mean, it gives you that rush of infatuation if you're madly in love, definitely.
Now, at one point in your book, you write, I came to believe that romantic love is a primary motivation system in the brain. In short, a fundamental human drive. Why is this important, this phrase, motivating system? And what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, there's all kinds of things that the brain does. We think, you know, we'll do logical thinking, and much of the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain right behind your forehead, deals with making decisions, making plans. And then we have all kinds of emotional circuits where we have feelings like anger, fear, joy, surprise, disgust. And those are generally a little bit lower down in the brain. And then really near the base of the brain, at the core of the brain, are motivation centers. These are centers that give you craving, that when you want a piece of chocolate, when you're thirsty, when you're hungry, when you want something, when you're motivated to get something, is those motivation centers that are involved. So basically, we're using all parts of the brain all of the time. I mean, let's say you want your sweetheart. Well, you've got the motivation motor going on. You've got the prefrontal cortex making the plans, and you've got emotion centers feeling abandonment or joy or thrill. So, you know, I think that romantic love has many things that are going on at the same time, cognitive things, emotional things, and motivational things. But we found activity in the motivation centers, the centers that enable you to focus your attention on what you want and go after it. And that's, I hadn't expected that. I had thought that we would find activity in the emotion centers because I had thought, well, you know, romantic love is a whole pile of different feelings from great joy to great sorrow. But what it really is a motivation system, a wanting system. It's part of the come-go system in the brain. And I then, in the book, went one step farther and I said, well, if this is a motivation system, I think it's a drive, a basic motivation system. And in fact, I would have called that book The Drive to Love rather than Why We Love. But other people didn't like that. But to me, that's very meaningful because I think romantic love is stronger than the sex drive. You know, if you ask somebody to go to bed with you and they say no thanks, you don't go killing yourself or killing them or slipping into a clinical depression or stalking them. But when you're rejected in love, people all over the world, and for as long as we've got data, they have hung themselves, killed somebody else, stalked somebody, slipped into clinical depression. So the drive to love, certainly stronger than the sex drive, can be stronger than the will to live. We've got songs, poems, plays, sculptures, paintings, myths, legends, evidence of suicide, homicide, everywhere in the world. So I think it's the strongest motivation system of the human animal.
So they would see these pictures and their brains would literally light up in particular areas.
Well, certain areas would suck up the blood and to get the oxygen and the glucose. And in order to suck up the blood, they would create more activity. And it was that magnetic activity that we're actually measuring. So you take the brain slice by slice and you can look and see which regions are working and which are shutting down, actually. Parts of the brain shut down when you're madly in love. In fact, a very interesting part shuts down. A part of the brain associated with fear, a part of the amygdala associated with fear, which is one of the characteristics of romantic love. You become really rather fearless. You're willing to do all kinds of crazy things because you're madly in love. It overcomes your rational mind.
So you're looking at the images of the brain, people madly in love, these certain areas are stimulated. What does this mean chemically?
I had hypothesized that we would find evidence for elevated activity of the dopamine system and the norepinephrine system. These are natural stimulants in the brain. They give you feelings of elation, giddiness, euphoria, focused attention, motivation, heightened energy, sleeplessness, loss of appetite. These are basic characteristics of romantic love. And I thought we would also find low activity of serotonin because low activity of serotonin is associated with obsessive-compulsive behaviors. And certainly the main characteristic of romantic love is you can't stop thinking about this individual. It is an obsession. So that was my hypothesis as I went in. What we ended up finding is activity in this ventral tegmental area in a region that actually makes dopamine and sends dopamine to many brain regions. We did not find activity of norepinephrine, but I really think that that's also involved. We just haven't found it yet. It doesn't mean it's not there. The reason I think norepinephrine will be involved is because it's norepinephrine that gives you what they call the sweaty palms syndrome, the pounding heart, the dry mouth, the sweaty palms, the kinds of things that happen when you're really incredibly in love with somebody and don't know yet whether they love you.
So romance is as important as eating? Drinking? Breathing?
Well, it can be stronger than all of those because some people give up all that in order to win somebody or get out of life when they don't win somebody. Most of us don't, though, of course, and eating and drinking is extremely important. I mean, you've got to survive. But you know what? I mean, I think that romantic love evolved for a very fundamental reason. I think it evolved to enable us to focus our mating energy on just one individual at a time, thereby conserving mating time and energy and starting the most important thing we'll do with our lives, which is forming a pair bond and raising creating a child. I think the sex drive evolved to get you out there looking for a whole range of partners. I mean, you can have sex with somebody you're not in love with. And I think that attachment, that third brain system, that third drive, evolved to enable us to tolerate this individual at least long enough to rear a child together. So I think these three different drives, the sex drive, romantic love, and attachment, all are operating in all kinds of combinations to direct our reproductive lives. And you ask me, is this more important than eating and drinking? Sure, it is.
What about lust? What about the sex drive? What are the chemicals there? Are they different from the romance chemicals?
The main chemical of the sex drive is testosterone in both men and women. In fact, you know, you inject testosterone in any kind of animal and sex drive goes up. And the brain system is different, too. I mean, there's at least five brain scanning studies of the sex drive, and the various brain regions involved they overlap, but they're different from those regions associated with romantic love. So there's two different systems, but they interact. And that's what's so interesting to me. For example, you know, when you fall in love with somebody, suddenly that person becomes enormously sexually attractive to you. 3 weeks ago, it was just another nice person at the office or in your social circle or at the gym. But suddenly, everything they do becomes attractive to you. And I think that it is in part because elevated activity of the dopamine circuits associated with romantic love trigger testosterone and trigger the sex drive. So this is why it is that you suddenly become almost, totally fixated sexually on somebody who you're in love with. What I find most remarkable about these three drives, the sex drive, romantic love, and attachment, is that they're often unconnected. You can feel a powerful sense of attachment to a long-term partner while you feel intense romantic love for somebody else, while you feel this sex drive for a whole range of people. So this is what gets the human animal in so much trouble.
I bet. Now, how does let's go back now to lust or the sex drive and romance. You say that romance can kindle the sex drive. What about the other way around? Can lust lead to romance?
Not always, of course. You know, most liberated adults have copulated with somebody who they never fell in love with. In fact, they would have liked to have fallen in love with them and couldn't do it. But it certainly can happen. And it can happen, I think, in part because with orgasm, there's a spike of dopamine. It just shoots up and shoots down again. And that, I think, can help change the threshold for your ability to fall in love and just turn you over that edge. Also, with orgasm, you get a real flood in the brain of oxytocin and vasopressin, and these are the chemicals associated with attachment. So casual sex isn't always that casual. As a matter of fact, I think women are more vulnerable than men are because, as it turns out, seminal fluid has in it all the chemicals for the sex drive, the testosterone and estrogen, oxytocin and vasopressin associated with attachment, and dopamine and norepinephrine associated with romantic love. So a man is actually doing some chemical finagling when he deposits his sperm. So, you know, casual sex can be casual, but generally it's not.
All right. Just continuing now on the casual sex department, Let's talk about the sex differences here. I mean, the conventional wisdom is that guys are much more interested in that than women, or at least acted out more.
You know, we come from 10,000 years of women being really secondary citizens. In many hunting and gathering societies, they certainly believe that women are just as sexually active as men are. And I wrote about this in another one of my books, The First Sex, in which I say the more, you know, what's really going on, I mean, one of the huge social trends right now is women piling into the job market in cultures around the world. And as they move more and more into the job market, they're becoming economically more powerful. And with that, we're seeing female sexual expression. And I think we're just at the turning point, the tipping point, in which we're going to come to understand that women are just as sexual as men are. It's just that they express it differently. I mean, just for openers, all of these men who are being adulterers, who are they sleeping with? I mean, this doesn't make any sense. I mean, this is basic math. They've got to be sleeping with women.
Isn't it Mae West, who said, though, that there's a reason for, you know, if a woman gets around, then and the guy is interested in the history there. You know, history is,
yeah, right,
proven this is all very possible.
You know, the question becomes, you know, I mean, there could be a few women who are sleeping with all of these men, and all the rest are the Madonna and the whore kind of syndrome. Or men are bragging and women are lying even to themselves. And the only really good study of this comes out of London, and they ended up concluding that men are bragging and inflating the numbers of their actual sexual partners, and women are lying to themselves. So who's to know? But the point is, you know, adultery is not the only part of sexuality. I mean, you know, men tend to think about sex more regularly. But in the bedroom, the female sexual response is more intense. They have more of the major contractions of orgasm. They last for a longer period of time. They're more likely to be able to have multiple orgasm. Men's sexuality peaks somewhat younger, in their early 20s. Female sexuality peaks later, in their late 20s. And of course, most people are studying college students, so they're going to be studying male sexuality, not female sexuality. Female sexuality tends to be more enduring over the lifespan. As men get older, they have more sex problems than women do. Women embed sex in a broader sensual world than men do. Men tend to just focus on orgasm. Women are more bisexual than men. Men tend to be one way or the other. So there's various differences. But who can say which has the more powerful sex drive? It's a question of how you define sex drive.
What about these figures that show that 10% of children born into a family aren't genetically connected to the putative dad?
Isn't that unbelievable? I remember the very first study was done in the 1940s in a hospital in Los Angeles. And what they did is they were studying blood groups. They weren't even studying sexuality. And they wanted to see how various blood groups were inherited. So they took the blood of new mothers, new fathers, and the babies as they were all going out of the hospital. And they ended up finding that over 10% of those babies were literally not the children of the fathers that were holding them in their arms. And so this was a revelation to everybody. And by the way, those are the women who actually had a baby. Think of all the women who didn't have a baby. You know, I mean, I don't want to advertise female adultery, but I just would like people to be a little bit reasonable and begin come to understand that women are sexual beings too.
What are the chemicals involved with what you call attachment?
Well, there's other scientists who've studied this, and this is some really elegant work on attachment in other animals, basically the prairie vole. Prairie vole is like a little field mouse, and there's been some wonderful studies that indicate that the basic hormones and neurotransmitters actually are oxytocin and vasopressin, and these are chemicals that that women actually really put off when they are delivering a child and the letting down of the milk. And they now realize that the oxytocin is also associated with mother-infant bonding. But these studies with prairie voles indicate that they are also associated with mammalian male-female bonding. And as a matter of fact, there's a wonderful new study in which they've discovered that even holding somebody, hugging somebody, drives up levels of oxytocin. In fact, picking up a child, when a man picks up a child, levels of testosterone go down and probably levels of oxytocin go up.
What are the reactions that people have to these chemicals of oxytocin and vasopressin?
Well, I think we've all felt them, you know, that sense of warmth and security and friendliness. I mean, you know, conjure up the moments that you feel after making love to somebody and everybody's had an orgasm, and it's a sense of sort of almost a cosmic unity, but also the kind of feeling when you're off on a business trip and you suddenly feel a need to for the comfort of home, and you call home and suddenly you feel better. Levels of oxytocin and vasopressin are probably going up. These are associated with calm, relaxation, peace, security, trust, all associated with those chemicals.
Hmm. And what parts of the brain are involved with these chemicals?
Well, so far, the research seems to indicate that certain parts of the nucleus accumbens is associated with oxytocin activity in females and vasopressin activity in something else called the ventral pallidum in males. There's going to be more to the system. I mean, these are big systems. You know, these are basic chemicals. I mean, all of the mammals and birds and have these chemicals. They have them in different balances. And as a result, these animals, I think, feel romantic love and feel attachment. They just do it under different circumstances. For example, you can see a fox in the beginning of the mating season really behaving as if he's in love. He follows the female doggedly. He prances about. He's got so much energy. He needs very little sleep. He's not at all hungry. He does all these affiliative gestures of licking and snuggling and nuzzling and characteristics of romantic love. And it lasts about 2 weeks in foxes, and it lasts 1 to 3 years in people. So same thing with attachment. I mean, some animals form a very brief attachment. They don't form pair bonds at all. Others form lifelong attachments. So it's not as much what the chemicals are involved, but the ratios of those chemicals, where they're acting in the brain, that determines an animal's basic behavior patterns.
So in other words, our dog that seems so devoted, in fact, does love us?
Yep, he does, or she does. And in fact, 97% of mammals do not pair up to rear their young. All of the wild canids, wolves, foxes, coyotes, wild dogs, dingoes, and domestic dogs have inherited this drive, I think, to form a deep attachment, a pair bond. And so that's one of the reasons that they attach with people. You know, it's now thought, a girlfriend of mine, Barb Smutza, has told me this. She studies dogs, and apparently they now think that that it's dogs that domesticated man, not man that domesticated dogs, that by 100,000 years ago, you know, dogs are very good at sniffing out and following and tracking, right? Mm-hmm. But a lot of wolves die out when they go in for the kill because they don't have tools and weapons. Human beings, we've got a dreadful nose. We're terrible at tracking and surrounding, but we're very good with our spears and everything at actually killing the animals. So it's thought that the dog saw the abilities of man or just suddenly, you know, unconsciously realized it would be a better deal for them if they followed along, helped, got the men to, they would track the game after it was wounded. They would track it and follow it and then wait for the men to go in and kill it and then give them some of the meat.
Now, you also said that you looked at people who had just been jilted or dumped or crushed.
Right.
What happened? Yeah. What happened in their brains?
Well, first of all, Steve, I want to tell you how hard that was to do. You know, I interviewed all these people before I put them in the machine. But people who've just been dumped are in horrible shape. I mean, there were times that I had to go step into a dark room and collect myself and then go back and talk to them because, boy, some of these were furious. Some of them were almost paranoid. Some of them were deeply depressed. I mean, romantic rejection is no joke. And so what I did, they did the same experiment. They would look at a photograph of their sweetheart, and they would also look at a neutral photograph. We found a lot of things, but among the things that we found is we found activity in a brain region, the insular cortex, where other experiments have shown that this particular region is associated with physical pain in the skin and muscles, not just psychological pain when you're rejected, but physical pain. We also found activity in a brain region called the nucleus accumbens. It's a brain region This particular part of the nucleus accumbens is associated with risking, taking big risks, actually gambling for money, taking big risks for big gains and big losses. And of course, that's what you do when you've been rejected. You're just willing to do just about anything to win this person back. And then we also found activity in a brain region near the front of the brain called the lateral orbitofrontal cortex. And this brain region, this particular part of the cortex, is associated with three things: obsessive and compulsive behaviors, and of course you obsessively think about this person, with controlling anger, and that's one thing that happens when you get dumped. You get angry. Most people do. And last but not least, this is a brain region associated with what scientists call a theory of mind. And what theory of mind is when people do it, probably much more than other animals, projecting yourself into another person's shoes and thinking, what is he thinking about? What is he doing? What is he planning? He's thinking about this or that. That's theory of mind. And that's what happens when you get rejected. You feel physical pain. You're willing to take huge risks. You're constantly wondering what this other person is thinking. You're obsessively thinking about them, and you're trying to control your anger.
So tell me now, what does your study of the brain and its chemistry tell us now about divorce and also the species, too, because you seem to look at the whole ecology of the human as you're sorting through this?
Well, you know, I wrote a book, a different book, about divorce. It was called Anatomy of Love. And I looked at divorce in 58 societies through the demographic yearbooks of the United Nations. And I was expecting to find the 7-year itch, and that's what I was hoping to find, but I didn't find it. I found over and over people tend to divorce during and around the 4th year of marriage. First of all, I was astonished that there was any pattern at all, given the wide range of people that there are, the wide range of cultural beliefs. But there is a pattern. And it began to occur to me that maybe we evolved this 4-year itch to stay together at least long enough to raise a single child through infancy, about 4 years.
What is the secret of making love last? I mean, can you tell us what you found about this?
I want to say, first of all, that there's very nice data that in long-term attachments, you can make love last. That indeed, if it's a very good relationship, there often is a continual thread of romantic love in the relationship, as well as deep attachment to the person. You'll feel the romantic love when you're on a vacation, when suddenly you go out on a date with your husband or wife, when something fun happens, when he cracks a joke, when he's wearing a beautiful suit, et cetera, et cetera. It can come back. But anyway, one of the ways to sustain romantic love in a long-term marriage is to do novel, exciting, slightly dangerous things together, because novelty drives up the activity of dopamine in the brain. This is why vacations can be so exciting, just doing something new.
A lot of people are out there on drugs that keep a lot of serotonin circulating in the body. And as I recall, you said to be romantic, you want to have really low, or you're going to have really low levels of serotonin. So does that mean that people who are on those drugs aren't particularly romantic, maybe can't even get romantic?
Well done. This is one of my newest ideas, and I feel very strongly about this. There's millions of Americans and many more millions of people around the world who are taking these SSRIs, their serotonin boosters, things like Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, etc. And what these things do is drive up the level of serotonin in the brain. And it's very well known that elevated activity of serotonin suppresses the dopamine circuits, and romantic love is associated with the dopamine circuits. When you are driving up the serotonin, you are jeopardizing your ability to fall in love and to stay in love. Not only does the serotonin suppress the dopamine circuits, it blunts the emotions. Well, romantic love is about the emotions. It also blunts obsessive thinking. That's why you take the drugs. Romantic love, the main characteristic of romantic love is obsessive thinking. So you are jeopardizing your ability to fall in love and stay in love when you take these serotonin-enhancing antidepressants. I'm not suggesting that you don't take them. I mean, if you're going to kill somebody else or kill yourself, you should probably take them. All I'm saying is that these are very strong drugs, and when you tamper with one brain system, you're going to ultimately affect other brain systems too, particularly very important ones, your ability to fall in love and feel that rush, and also your ability to feel deep attachment. And in fact, the way it can affect the serotonin system affects attachment is through the sex drive. You know, 70% of people who are on these serotonin-enhancing medications lose their sex drive. And when you lose your sex drive and don't have sex with somebody, you are losing that moment when you're driving up oxytocin and vasopressin. So you're killing some of the attachment chemicals in the brain as well as the sex drive. There's many other ways that these serotonin-enhancing antidepressants can affect romantic love and marriage.
Helen Fisher's book is called Why We Love, The Nature and Chemistry of Romantic Love. Thank you so much, Helen Fisher.
Thank you.